From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made with one word, certainty. How certain are you of your own beliefs? How certain are you that your beliefs are correct and true and maybe even morally strong? How much doubt do you feel? When is the last time you changed your mind about a major issue? My guest this hour is a retired pastor who has, in my estimation, a wonderful touch with people. Reverend Val Fowler talked a lot about faith during his decades in ministry, and he came to see that even the word faith can be confused. To Reverend Fowler, faith is the opposite of certainty, and doubt is healthy. When he engages with others, he's careful. He doesn't look to shame or mock or lecture. He's noticed that many of us have developed a habit of saying to someone, "Why do you believe that?" And it's not exactly a question, is it? It's more of an allegation. You believe something bad, and I'm going to condemn you. It's not an exploration of why someone came to believe something. It's a judgment. I asked Val to join us to talk about how we talk to each other. It's what he does so well. It's what I too often fail to do well, and I'm looking forward to learning from this conversation. The Right Reverend Val Fowler, His Holiness, retired pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Honeyeye Falls. How's that?
That's great. It's that is just a joke, but it's
a little much, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little much. For those who are listening who don't know me, in the churches I served, in the first newsletter, I would write a little article and admit that they were wondering what to call me. And I started saying, well, you can call me His Holiness, the Most Right Reverend Dr. Val Fowler, or you can call me Val. So, and then I mentioned in a note to Evan that 1 year after right the day that I came to Honeyeye Falls as pastor, I heard a senior high talking to younger kids and commented, "Isn't that Reverend Val something?" And there was something about that that touched me. And so that's how I was known in Honeyeye Falls, was Reverend Val. So
I think it's beautiful. You've been retired for how long, Val?
I retired September 1st, 2015. So it's been a little more than 5 years.
And so, you worked for how many years in the ministry and the faith?
40.
40 years.
So, and including an internship and three part-time works when I was in seminary, that would extend to 45. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. I was ordained in 1975.
Did you, you grew up in an evangelical family?
Well, I grew up in a Presbyterian family, but I grew up in the buckle of the Bible Belt, of which there are many. I grew up in Amarillo, Texas, and that culture in the Texas Panhandle is very, very conservative, always has been. So I grew up learning how the Southern Church of Christ and Southern Baptists and other conservative groups and Pentecostal groups, I learned what their language was. That's where I grew up in. Mm-hmm. So, and in some respects, it's been I've learned some things, but it's also been kind of a struggle with that approach. So,
well, if I could, I want to talk to you about certainty, about faith, about belief, about how we interrogate our own beliefs and how we talk to each other. And I want to go back to my college days. I was sort of an interesting, well, I don't think I'm interesting, but an unusual case, I guess. I was baptized Presbyterian in a family that really didn't go to church and mm-hmm. I didn't really grow up with much of a faith tradition. And I turned 14 and I really wanted to sort of solve the mysteries of the universe at the age of 14, and started thinking about God and started thinking about a lot of different things. And I went to all kinds of different faith communities and chose on my own to convert to Catholicism. I liked the Mass. I liked the ceremony, and had a confirmation, a First Communion, all of that on the same day. And then I got to college and I studied it more. And the more I read holy books, the less comfortable I was. And then finally, the pastor at the church where I was when I was in college, he gave a sermon in which he talked about how doubt is weakness. And when we doubt the Lord, you know, we are not loving the Lord and we are not loving ourselves. And on the subject of love, he said that only God knows what real love is. Not even your own mother knows what real love is next to the Lord. And I thought, I'm not really sure that I'm digging this message. And Pastor Fowler, I understand that was one person in one setting. But it turned me off, and I kept reading and studying, and I've sort of drifted into this spiritual existentialism, or maybe I'm afraid to just call it skepticism or atheism. But that's been sort of my path. And I was really surprised to hear a pastor telling his flock that doubt is weakness. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. I can still hear my grandfather saying, long may he rest in peace, the worst sin is doubt. Mm. I remember hearing that. I remember at some point, I don't know when, I started to question that. For one thing, I think the first time in Sunday school we studied the story of Thomas, and nowhere the word doubting is mentioned toward the end of that story. But Thomas, who was not with the disciples when Jesus first appeared, was with them 7 days later, and Jesus appeared to him the same as he appeared the second time to the others. So he was a part of the community when he said, well, I didn't see it. When I'll believe when I see the holes. So I started to question whether the greatest sin is doubt, because he was still a part of the community. He had not been rejected. There's nothing in the story that indicates that he was rejected by Jesus. Nor is there any indication that he was rejected by the other disciples. There are only, maybe out of the 12 that are listed in all the Gospels, there's only 5 or 6, maybe 7, whose names are mentioned in all 4 of the Gospels, and Thomas is one of them. So I began to question about that. And then I began in my ministry in Oklahoma was 45 miles from Tulsa. So I was in the community of Oral Roberts and the community of other famous evangelists that were from Oklahoma or near. And one of my Sunday drills before I went to church to lead worship was to listen to those programs because I wanted to see what they were saying. And there was just a lot of what they were saying that I thought was not right, but they were so certain, mm-hmm. and their certainty led them to such judgmentalism. Earthquake to that was seeing where some of their lives ended up 5-10 years later. And they were committing the same things they said hundreds of people were going to hell for. And that's when, and it may have been something that I read too that triggered the notion that, look, wait a minute, faith, if faith is defined correctly in the first verse of Hebrews, faith is the assurance of things unseen and the convictions of things that have not arrived, then it's not a doubt to contradict that. It occurred to me that what contradicts faith is certainty. I can be certain, but once I've reached a level of certainty, especially when it reaches out to condemn others, then I don't believe that the issue with me, if I reach that point, is faith anymore, because I'm presenting that there's nothing that's unseen and nothing that is hoped for. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, and I just feel that certainty is projected as some sort of strength instead of a potential recklessness. I am sure that I am guilty of that. I mean, more than I'd like to admit.
Well, I'm sure, too. I do not deserve a part of your introduction to me that I do this communication so well, because I know there are a bunch of people listening that know that I don't.
Unfortunately, this is one where you have to let the community decide, and I have let the community decide, and this is your reputation. So you're going to have to take it, Reverend.
Well. at any rate, I really do believe more than we allow. People need to be given points for trying, at least. But the other thing is self-reflection. When we fail to do that, and I'll go back to what you described, and I'll just suggest this, that especially when I began working as stated clerk of our presbytery, which is kind of as close as Presbyterians can come to having a canon lawyer in the Catholic Church, and it's a position that's infused with a whole lot of presumed authority and power. Well, within my first 4 years as stated clerk, I was helping the presbytery manage a resurfaced case and three other cases of pastoral sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. And a couple of other cases where pastors was accused of behavior, not sexual behavior, but other behavior that was inconsistent. So right off the way, in fact, the first piece of mail I received the day that I became officially stated clerk was a letter informing me that a pastor in our presbytery had been accused of sexual misconduct or sexual abuse in the presbytery he came from. And through that, I learned that pastors have an immense amount of power, and yet they are very willing to talk about how powerless they are. In other words, I'm powerless to crawl into someone's wallet and make them give money to the church. I'm powerless to have them like me. I'm powerless to this, and this. I've heard that language at times. I've even used it. But the truth is, not only will people in the pews believe what I say because of the role I'm in, they are wired to believe it. And if I lead them astray, or if I make it about me and not about them and what God is doing in our lives, then I am abusing my power. And when I learned the ways that ministers would justify, and actually heard some of them from their mouths, the only thing I could think that it's not an issue of consent, it's not an issue of a mistake, it's an issue of abuse of power. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When a denomination, of which we can name a couple, respond to widespread allegations of sexual abuse by not releasing that information, they have abused their power by failing to disclose to the people of God what is happening in the life of the people of God. So I really, really, really began to take seriously what I would say in that context where people are wanting to believe that what I say is true. And they're wired to do that. So God forgive me if I should abuse that power. And for me, in the role of speaking a word to the people, I'm the only one speaking.
Yeah, there's
It's not a dialogue. It's a lot of weight. And, you know, when you talk about, I think journalists and pastors, and I think there are a lot of other people who have a burden that they may not recognize. I realized it really quickly that no matter what people say about how hard and it is to be a minister, the hardest thing I think is just about every one of your mistakes is public. I don't have the privilege of making mistakes privately.
Can we talk,
I really don't.
Can we talk a little bit about this? Because I'm glad you bring this up, and I think it will bring me to where I'd like to go eventually, which is to talk about kindness and generosity. And I have a very interesting comment from a listener named Scott. And Scott, I appreciate that. We're going to get to that in a moment here. But sure, mistakes are public. And my mistakes, when you do 500 hours of live radio a year, the mistakes are many, and I promise you the listeners will let you know.
Absolutely.
That is part of the deal. When you are the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Honeyoye Falls, your congregation will let you know when they think you have erred. What I want to just reference is that I think it was maybe 5 years ago, Val, that I used a phrase on this radio program and live radio that is one of the most awful anti-Semitic phrases. It's not a single word. It's a phrase.
I had
no idea that the phrase was anti-Semitic. It was one of those phrases that I probably heard back to childhood. I thought it was a colorful way to describe people in general who were venal. And I just didn't know.
Yep.
So I heard from some listeners, and almost all of the feedback was so kind and with so much grace, and including an email from a listener who said, you know, Evan, I listen just about every day, and, it seems that I feel like I know you pretty well. I think there's no way that you know the history of this phrase, and I just want you to be aware of it, not to shame you, but to let you know. And so I remember sitting in my office and I'm looking this up and I was horrified, just horrified and embarrassed and angry with myself. And, you know, I mentioned it on the air the next day and I sent this long note back to the listeners who'd reached out to me. And all I could do was own it. But I will tell you, Val, I mean, the grace that was showed to me, whether I deserved it or not, was something I will never forget. I am not using this to say no one should ever be upset with others or call for anyone's firing, et cetera. I'm not saying that. I am saying that even in the moments where I feel outraged at something someone has done or said, I ask myself if I ought to be showing more grace. And sometimes the answer is yes, if that makes sense.
Right. And if I remember, I think it was maybe even the next day that you offered a very sincere apology for
I
remember that.
I did.
Because I think most people are also wired. Some of the wiring is really hidden and you have to look for it. But I think most people are wired to be gracious because that's how our species has survived for so many thousands and thousands of years. And while those kind of criticisms, when I receive them, just hurt me to the core, I become able sooner to recognize that those criticisms were not made to make me question my calling or made me think that I'm, in your case, a lousy journalist or an insensitive human being. They are made to help you.
Indeed.
And you cannot do what you do, and I could not have done for 40 years what I did without the help of a whole lot of people. And I would just say, in the many, many times I've heard you, you model giving that back, that grace, because when you've received that grace, how can you not be generous with giving it back? Because it's so profound. It was about 3 years before I retired that I walked the hardest 100 yards a minister would ever have to walk. Because there was a reason that contributed. But what I did was I forgot a graveyard service for a member of my church. Something had happened that morning and something had happened that afternoon, which kind of really brought me to my knees. Mm-hmm. And I heard a sound in the driveway and I went downstairs and it was a member of the church saying, Val, honey, are you coming to the graveside service? And you can imagine what I said in my head. I said, I will be there in 5 minutes. And I got myself cleaned up and dressed, and I was. I had to walk 100 yards to 60 people whom I loved and cared about, who knew that I had really screwed up. And I walked there, and all I said was, I am so sorry, and started the service. And then had a couple of conversations afterward. Later that afternoon, after I knew that the family gathering after had ended, I called the husband. And I apologized to him. And I would rank that as one of the two or three most significant times I've received grace in my life. And he wasn't dismissively saying those things happened. He basically was saying, I understand. It's okay. It's okay, Val. It's okay. The funeral service had been held a month and a half before. But the graveside service, because the family was far-flung, was held that day. And I had to walk 100 yards, not wanting to take a single one of those steps. And I think there are probably five times the number of stories of people listening of the grace that they've seen like that. And that's what I'm after. I didn't have a reputation of really disagreeing with people. I didn't have a reputation of beating people up. I did have a reputation for being articulate and for being pretty direct about what I believe. But I really tried to do it within the context of grace.
If I could...
That's all I can say.
Yeah. And if I could then... ask for your sort of view on how we let me go ahead and read this note that I think will help. The listener named Scott sent me a note when he heard me mention coming up to the program that one of my goals is to sort of get us back on a track to being kinder to one another. And Val, when my son was born, I thought about what I could tell him going to bed every night, because at least he's a captive audience and he had to listen to me, particularly when he couldn't talk.
You know?
that's the one of the powers of fatherhood. You have to listen for a little while.
And talk about someone who's wired to believe
exactly
that what you say is right.
He's full of motivated reasoning and,
gosh.
So what I tell him at bed every night is I tell him, be kind to everyone you meet. Be generous and be thankful for everything you have. And that's it. And I do that because I thought about what would make me proud of him as a person. And what are the things that I think are the foundation of a good life? People who are constantly wanting what others have are generally not very happy. People who are obsessed with competition and ranking orders are generally not as happy. And people who think about what they don't have as opposed to what they do have are not very happy. And he has a lot. And I just wanted him to know that. But the kindness part's important. And we emphasize that. Now, having said that, Val, when I think about the grace that the listener showed me or the story that you just shared with a family showing grace to you and how it impacted you and the kindness you felt when maybe it wasn't even deserved. Scott writes to me to say, Evan, getting back to kindness is a tricky conversation to have because for many marginalized folks, kindness has never been a thing for us. As a gay man, the world has never felt kind. That's a powerful note to get because it reminds me that there is a bit of a bubble for me to say, well, can't we just be kinder to one another? Can't we just show grace to one another? Because it's easy for me to decide to show grace. There's nothing I have that's really at risk, Val. I mean, I'm a pretty fortunate, I'm sort of the life's lottery of luck and advantage. But to Scott's point, careful on lecturing about kindness and grace for people who have always been sort of bereft of having any chance to receive it. What do you think about that?
Well, I would say, and maybe I am saying it to Scott, but if Scott and I were sitting down somewhere and he had heard me say something about kindness and said what he said, I would listen and I would agree. I said, I would say, you have hit a nail right on the head. It's a reality. And even people who try to live kindness have had many experiences where either they have treated people unkindly or whether serious unkindness had been treated to them. But who can, I don't believe anyone can really argue that speaking as an American citizen, our history is full of thousands and thousands and thousands of people to which our country has not expressed kindness. For many of them, they are left in a position of simply surviving, in the words of the old hymn, one day at a time, if not 1 hour at a time. I have witnessed societal abuse where I grew up. And I hope I would be able to reach the point where I could say to Scott, the fact that you wrote that note in the way you wrote it is itself an act of kindness that acknowledges the pain that you have lived with, acknowledges your experience of mostly feeling anything but kind. But somehow, you yourself are a note of grace in expressing that reality in a way that someone can respond to it helpfully. And I would also say, I darn sure hope, should we meet or relate further on, that I can be one of the many people that you need who are the exception, and that it is possible to have grace. One of my best friends in my life that I don't see very often is a gay person who founded the LGBTQ alliance in the community where he is living at a university. The gold standard of a marriage relationship that I always look back to, and I've seen this marriage relation, it's now a marriage relationship, was a gay lesbian couple. And they were, the one was a part of, had been a part all her life of the church I was serving. Her partner came to me one day and I believe had the trust to be able to say to me, this is who I am. Is there a place for me in your church? In this church, she said, not my church, in this church. And I looked at her, and the first thing that came out of my mouth was, why wouldn't there be? You know, why wouldn't there be? Because of some moral judgment? I don't know. Patty Larkin once wrote a wonderful song called Mary Magdalene. I encourage people to type in Patty Larkin, Mary Magdalene, the only acoustic solo song on the album in which it first appeared. And here's this song. And in one place, she gives voice saying, I took off running just to feel the wind. No, something. Anyway, it says, there is no ever after everything I've done. I'm all broke up. I'm all broke down. Got turned around somehow. Who is my savior now? And those people walk through the doors of the churches almost every week, whether they are members or not. Mm. On what basis would I say you're not welcome. I know people have a basis to say that, but and I've related to a ton of them, and they've related to a ton of me. But for me, the day that I diswelcome somebody from a church I am serving is a day I need to find something else to do.
Well, and Reverend Val, to Scott's, probably to Scott's disappointment, and for many people who have viewed in the Catholic Church Pope Francis as perhaps a more inclusive figure, I think he undeniably is in many ways. But at the same time, the recent commentary from the Vatican about same-sex marriage and it feels like another door slamming when there was it had cracked open with some hope. So you can understand why I think people like Scott would say, just when you start to feel like the world is becoming more kind, there are still people reminding you from positions of power whether you are welcome or not. And I think I just want to echo your point, Reverend, about Scott. I mean, I'm really grateful for that feedback. The vast majority of feedback, even the harshest criticism of the show and of me, is helpful to me. And I certainly welcome it. But I think news like that out of the Vatican only sort of confirms that folks like Scott are in a different position than someone like me. And I've got to be careful about telling everybody, just be nicer, just be kinder when the world doesn't feel kind. Yeah.
Downtown church in our community was a flashpoint around that particular issue. And I've known downtown church since I was serving in Texas because I knew of what they were doing in a wide range of ministries. And at one point I said to the pastor of a church that was seriously contemplating leaving the denomination because in our presbytery, they always seem to be on the losing side. Well, to that person, I said, well, guess who's been on the losing side? Guess who you share that with? Downtown church, with respect to the denomination, has always been on the losing side, and they're not talking about leaving. But I also said to our presbytery council and to our committee on ministry, the vote on ordination and same-sex unions has been always 60-40 in the years that I have been here. 60 in favor, 40 against, and it never moved more than 2 or 3 percentage points either way. The 40% or 3% less or more, maybe 75% of those were the same churches, but there were 25%, depending on how it was framed, that were different. So I said, what is our ministry to those who, out of their own serious beliefs, find themselves constantly on the losing side of the argument? What's our ministry to them? What do we have to offer them in the spirit of what we claim to those who consistently find themselves on the other side? I think that's a good question to ask. And there was a bit of transforming that came out of that. So I don't know. I just think when I found out in my first parish that we had the largest number of female candidates in the former Presbyterian Church U.S. denomination, the so-called Southern Church. And we did. We had more female candidates for ministry than any other presbytery in that denomination. But when I did some looking and saw that we had one part-time female associate pastor in the presbytery, and we were challenged about that by a female candidate. From that day forward, for the last 2.5 years in the church I served, the only male voice in that pulpit was mine. Because I figured if anything is going to happen with this issue, is people need to realize that the people involved are not issues. The people involved have a calling. So I invited every current candidate to preach in that church with the church board's understanding that they would be paid as if they were a guest minister, but I would be there. And I made it clear to my session and to the person who came, I was not doing that to have any kind of oversight. I was doing it because I was going to be there to validate that women were not just to be seen as the substitute for the guy. They preached on their own right. That church became the first church in that presbytery to ordain a female full-time solo pastor in the history of the presbytery.
Can I just pop in for a moment here and say, I'm late for a break, but what I want to ask you on the other side of this is how you work through the differing positions on, for example, sometimes it's women ordination, women in the pulpit. Sometimes it's equal marriage and, welcoming gay couples to church. And like you said, a congregation that might be split 60-40. On the other side of this, I want to ask you about how you sort of navigate some of those conversations that seem to feel, at least to me lately, a little bit more intractable, a little less malleable, a little bit more of the, well, why do you believe that, instead of tell me how you came to your beliefs so I can understand them better. Yeah. Let's take this break, and we're going to come back with Reverend Val Fowler, retired pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Honeoye Falls, and a man with more than 40 years experience doing what he has done in various communities around this country. We're grateful for his time and his thoughtful approach to the way we work with each other, and we'll continue with him next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, we talked to member of Rochester City Council Mary Lupien about the report to council regarding the death of Daniel Prude. In our second hour, a discussion about pandemic ethics. University of Rochester Professor Richard Deese joins us to talk about the allocation of resources, the lessons we've learned when it comes to making these decisions, who gets the vaccine, who doesn't, and more. That's Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Andy writes to say, certainty is a prism, locking one away from new ideas to find. When I look back upon this life, I'm not ashamed to say I changed my mind. A short poem inspired by the conversation on Connections today. Thank you, Andy. Beautiful stuff, and I'm right there with you. Certainty can be really sort of a form of locking up ourselves from new experiences and new ideas. Rick says, as I listen to your guest, Reverend Fowler, it is clear that he maintains a sense of curiosity and avoids being judgmental. Maybe his training as a minister contributed to that. I think of how the late Mr. Rogers of PBS always listened well and demonstrated curiosity. I believe he was also an ordained minister. I think that's right, Rick. And Rick says, I wonder if your guest can tell us more about how we might cultivate an attitude and practice similar to this. So before I get to a listener who's on the phone waiting, let's just explore what Rick is asking us to explore. That lack of judgment, that the way we interrogate one another's beliefs without making them feel like they're in a police interrogation. How do you do that, Val?
Oh, my heavens. I think, honestly, part of my answer to that is I don't know. If I'm able to do that, it's a sign of grace. But for me, it was, I guess one of the things I tried to cultivate is walking down the road, things that people say, and they say them so easily and so flippantly and certainly, without walking them down the road and see where that leads. For me, it's listening to things that it was, whether a teacher said it or someone in seminary or church member or whoever, someone on the air. I try to listen to where that's coming from. I try to cultivate in myself, really sometimes I ask myself, why do I believe that? I can tell you, I could give you most of the sermons I preached in 40 years, and what I began not doing. I can say, I think honestly, I tried never to tell my folks what they should do. I might give them things, I called it homework, to think about during the coming week, and then let's talk about it after. But I began thinking why I believe certain things. When I started looking for the last 20 years in the preaching and teaching task, I always tried to look for intersections between my life and other people's lives that I had observed. What's the intersection? And how do I make sense of that in my own life? And I think one of the profound things that the first person said, that certainty keeps me from saying some very important words. I was wrong, or I changed my mind. Mm-hmm. Now, we create a culture that makes that hard to do, because I have witnessed over the last 30 years, as I have listened to presidential campaigns in particular, it is now a grave American sin to change your mind.
Sure is.
Well, how the heck did we get there? How can the fact that I changed my mind be an impediment? So, for example, if it's a sin to change my mind, why ever would I even think of changing my mind about what the world might be for a gay person like Scott? Or what the world might be for a black child growing up? Or what the world may be for a Rohingya person in Myanmar, or standing and overlooking the largest housing development in Mexico City in 1987 when I was there, two communities of 12,000 people, the red-roofed community and the blue-roofed community, whose homes were in the Mexico City dump, watching kids dressed like my kids come off the school bus and go dancing down to their houses, as happy as any school kids were, but knowing that within 20 minutes they were going to be searching for recyclables in the city dump, and knowing that the waiting list to live there was larger than the 24,000 people who did. And I began asking the question then, and I asked it that night in our debriefing group. What would have to be happening in a person's life, probably a father or a mother, that they would think leaving their homes and probably walking for a good number of miles to have the prayer of a chance of living in the city dump, what has to be going on in their minds that they believe that that would be a good idea for them and their children? That's the kind of thing I've tried to cultivate in myself. And then the ability to try to say that in a way that people can hear it.
Well,
I don't know if that makes sense. I also find it very interesting just to observe people. Without being a weirdo, I really do try to observe people. And when they're involved in various kinds of discussions, I watch, I listen, and maybe too much, I take some of that inside, but there was an old quip years ago, how can we have a conversation when I'm thinking pastry and you're talking vegetables? We have to live into one another without judging them. The judgment may come later. Some judgments are realistic. But if we're not willing to open ourselves up to receive other people into a space in our life, we'll never really be able to have a healthy conversation.
Well, one more question on this, and then I'll grab that phone call. There's a gentleman who's been waiting to jump in here. But Val, I think some of it is because our beliefs become central to our identity. I mean, my feeling is that people are worthy of respect. Ideas and beliefs are worthy of interrogation. And
yes.
But often we, and I'm sure I do this myself, feel like you're attacking me personally if you attack the ideas. And sometimes that's because the attack of the idea comes with quite a lot of acid dripping off of it. So I understand that. But if you could address one point for me briefly, it's that sometimes listeners will say things like, look, I'm never going to believe the way person Y believes. Why do I need to know how they came to form that belief? They're wrong. What they believe is hurtful. I'll never believe that way. Why do I care how they formed that belief? Can you address a little bit of that?
Well, I think that's, I think, and this is another thing we've been duped by two things. We've been duped by a number of people who say there are no absolutes, and we've been duped by those who say, yes, there are. I don't know. For me, there are very few things in my life that I would sacrifice my life for. And a couple of them are thoughts that I will not sacrifice my life for those thoughts. Everything else is open for conversation. I used to say that if I say what I believe now before a denominational body in order to become a member of that Presbyterian body, if I were to say, I center my life on the person and work of Jesus Christ. That is non-negotiable for me. Everything else is up for grabs. I probably would not be accepted, but I believe that. So I think if I adopt the position that I'm never going to believe what you say, that may be true. But that then cuts off the possibility of my discovering who they are and they discovering who I am. And maybe there's something bigger between us than than the territory we claim that we are not going to give up, even for them. I've had good and lasting friendships, people that still connect with me, and we still disagree about almost everything, but we see and know one another as fellow human beings. I'm proud of that. I think when we adopt that position that we absolutely are not going to accept that, well, maybe that's not necessarily an unreasonable thing to say in certain contexts. But what it does, I think, is destroy or not maybe not destroy, but make difficult the very thing that we need to heal this broken world, and that is relationships that matter. Relationships of caring, relationships of respect. And I don't have to demand that a person agree with what I say, but I certainly believe they are bound as a fellow human being to respect me. And if my belief means that I can't respect them, then I have already dehumanized them. And there is no belief system that is worth anything that rests on dehumanizing other people. We experienced that in the late 1930s. Through 1945, and it still isn't over.
I've got to fit in a phone call, and this is Kirk Baker. Kirk Baker. Hi, Kirk.
Oh, Kirk Baker, the pastor of the church I served. Kirk.
Hi, Pastor.
Yeah, and Bale, one reason I'm in Honey Eye Falls is because you pastored there. Bale and I go back away.
Now you have someone to blame.
Oh, it's wonderful to follow you. I appreciate you're so gracious and humble in your mistakes I made in pastoring story. The reason why I wanted to call was not to joke with you, but it just occurs to me, you and I have had conversations about one of the greatest gifts you can do for yourself is to be a person of love rather than a person of hate.
Yeah.
And I hope that gets covered. I know we only have like 2 minutes, but I think that's so powerful when I think of people like Scott and I think of, you know, we all have those people as ministers whom we've met who have had that rebirth and how if you truly love yourself, then you want to be someone who loves because that's who you are, not because of anything anyone else does for you, not because of any social reason or social good. But that's the greatest gift you can give to yourself. So would you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Pastor Kirk, we've only got about 30 seconds left. So, Val, we're going to see how you do on the clock. Go ahead.
And precisely the question?
Well, I mean, the importance of being a person of love and not a person of hate.
Absolutely. And I will preface it by saying, like I said, the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is certainty. The opposite of love is not hate. Hate destroys community. Love, apathy destroys love. So the opposite of that is apathy. The importance of love is that love builds relationship. It doesn't destroy relationships. It just doesn't. Unless the thing I love is a substance that helps me destroy my life and the family around me, that's not real love. But between human beings, a sense of a person's holiness and worth as a person opens up the possibility to have a relationship. And I could do another program on the miracles if I witnessed in that.
Well,
and all I have to say in Honeyway Falls is one single name, and people will know what I'm talking about.
Reverend, we're going to lose the time here. Well, I want you, Reverend. Thank you. Come back sometime, will you? Thanks, everyone, for listening.